It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to explore how we can cook healthy foods that actually reflect culture and family. And with us today is Tamika Francis. And Tamika is a public health practitioner, but also a Jamaican chef, I think if I can describe it that way. Welcome, Tamika.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me on your show. A term I've been using recently is culinary creative. So
I love it.
It's open. It says I do a little bit of dabbling in the food, but it's very encompassing of the arts as well. So thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, this is wonderful. So I know that you started really down the path of feeling that there were cultures and peoples that were really underrepresented in the food. Not seen, in terms of recipes, all those things. And you really have moved along that path. Can you describe how you thought of that and then what happened in that process?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. So to answer that question, it's important to tell you my backstory. I moved to the US as an adult in my early 20s from Jamaica. Went to a Caribbean university, had always seen lots of folks from different islands. There were folks from Southeast Asia. Truly international, right? Even though we're in Jamaica, our motto is out of many, one people. So I was really accustomed to this like multifaceted culture. I eat lots of curries and stews and food from African diaspora and Asian food. So when I moved to the US, it was a little bit mind-boggling that foods were separated into ethnic food and American food. And I was like, wait, isn't America made up of all different kinds of ethnicities? So I struggled a little bit there and I left it alone for a while. And then I traveled a bit and felt like it was still just bothering me that I'd seen so many rich cultures and food stories across the world. But in Boston, where I was from or where I live, you only found ethnic food in quotations, right? In like low income neighborhoods. So I really wanted to do something. I could complain. But as an entrepreneur, I wanted to do something about that. So I partnered with amazing culinary talents, you know, colleagues of mine from Peru, from Ghana, from elsewhere. And we asked the question, like, what does home taste like for you? And home for me is Boston, is America, but home is also somewhere else. I wanted to put that on a plate. The mission was too big. I couldn't do it by myself. So I invited folks to be a part of a diaspora series with us. And so we did Jewish food, we did Peruvian food, Islamic food. And so we wanted to showcase amazing culinary stories on a plate in Boston.
That's really amazing. And you did, part of that was you did classes, right? I mean, you sort of had brought people together to experience the food, but to each other.
Yeah, so we've done classes, we've done pop-ups, we've also had conversations and consultations. I teach with Curious Spices, an amazing spice shop, initially in Cambridge, now in Winchester, Mass. Everything from stews and soups, always having spice as a centering piece. So, you know, the spice trade connected the Caribbean to Asia, to Latin America. So spice for me is a connecting piece between all our cultures. Curry, for example, I've done a curry class with Curio. And if you know the history of curry, it's from the subcontinent of India, but it's also lots of different types of curries.
Yeah, and that's kind of, it's made its way all the way around through parts of Africa, through, you know, Europe, and we get it here too, but you're right. It's funny. I want to go back on one thing. I noticed in what you were saying, something that I see here too, and that is we kind of almost neighborhood centric. We put our ethnic food in a neighborhood and leave it there. And it doesn't seem to go across. It's like when I'm in London, it's very different. In that, you know, I find all kinds of foods everywhere. But here I have to go find that neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm not sure when. I'm newer to America, and I think my responsibility to New America is to create one for my kids, for my family. And so that has been the trend. Maybe there was a distinct reason, maybe the way immigrants initially were in enclaves or lived together. But I think as a second gen, as you have like bicultural folks or newer, you know, Gen Zs and millennials, they are hyphenated humans, right? Their parents are from Ethiopia, their moms are from India. So I do think there's this opportunity lurking for the food scene to open up and just be American with global influences or global influence in America versus going to Chinatown just for Chinese food. I'd love to see amazing Asian food across all the towns or all the neighborhoods in any city.
Yeah, and you asked I think the most fundamental question you ask is, you know, what's home taste like or smell like?
Yeah.
And that idea, your home could be someplace that you actually never have been, true? I mean, it could be your home tradition, and meaning I feel like that's something that I honor and want.
Yeah, you're spot on. When we ask this question at our dinners, we've heard everything from stories of a smell nostalgia. I've heard stories of home taste like longing. I get chills just remembering a person who had spent time in a refugee camp. And for them, the description of home was a very basic, I think it was like millet, like a very basic, almost a poor meal, but it was memory of a time together of resilience. So the question isn't really about what you like to eat at home. Is what does home taste like for you? It may be a person, a familiarity. For me, it's lots of curry, it's lots of conversation during food. It's also rural Jamaica where I used to spend time with my grandparents. So for me, that question gets at the core of a person's like food story.
Yeah, I tried to eat healthier, but for me, it was as a kid growing up with one of my grandmothers who allowed me when I was a young boy to be with her all the time when she was cooking. And she was from West Virginia, and it was more of what I'd call a Southern style cooking. Lots of greens and whatever. They grew everything, and they butchered everything on their own because they would hunt and get it. And it was so, but I grew up with that experience. And to me, it's like she had this really crazy, delicious chicken and dumplings, which I don't do because, it's a lot of carbs and other things, but I still think of that as my home. It's funny. I have that in pies. You know, there were things that I participated in, stringing green beans with her, lots and lots of them, picking up apples. We did everything like that. And so for me, I get exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I'm smiling because I heard chicken and dumplings, and I just read, there's a cookbook, Jubilee by Tony Tipton Martin, and there's an amazing chicken and dumpling recipe.
I tried it.
Again, I'm sure I didn't do justice to what your grandma made, but it was just so homely, right?
I can't do justice either, but it was the whole experience. It was, so again, you're talking about, it was the conversation. So you're having conversations also, and that's part of your food memory.
It is. It definitely is conversation. Very rarely does food come without a good meal, come without conversation, right?
Right.
It's a sharing, it's a communal aspect of the meal you're having.
Wow. When we think about spice, we think about particularly some people that I think of are more of European descent that have a more bland diet. They think of spice as being hot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So when it goes yet spicy, well, it can be spicy, but not hot. How do you break down that barrier?
Yeah, spice has gotten a bad rep, right?
I agree.
Because technically, spice is a bark, seeds, roots, different parts of a tree that gives a flavor. So something as bland, I don't know what's bland, really. Cinnamon? No, that has spices, but it's not spicy. Usually for folks refers to hot or heat from pepper, and spice is really any variety of trees, barks, anything that gives you some flavor. I do think spice has a bad rep, but if folks have a chance to really taste spices individually, they'll find their profile. I like warm spices. So the cloves, the cinnamons, the nutmegs, the allspice, pimento is my profile. Some folks like more common, you know, like culinary lavender or rosemary, like more floral. So I think folks should try on a bunch of spices and see what works with their palate.
I agree with you. And I think the idea that it's the spice has really three, well, more even four qualities to it that attract our senses. Obviously, we think of it in a taste, mm-hmm. but we have different places that we taste different things in our mouth. So that's what's exciting is we're eliciting taste from there. And the other one is it's got smell. Mm-hmm. It's got texture.
Right.
That we both can feel on our tongue, but on our hand. And it also is visually, it will change colors of things and it's visually beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the best things I've ever learned in my culinary like training was around when you warm spices. So as you buy your spices from the store, the idea of toasting them or blooming your spices, in fact, it just wakes up the flavors in the spices and really changes your meal.
That's an interesting thing. Wakes up. Isn't that interesting? Wakes up a flavor. And sometimes we think spice overpowers, but it's not supposed to. It's supposed to wake a flavor that you're trying for in that.
Yeah. Way. It's supposed to enhance, right? So if you have a piece, let's say you have a piece of white meat and you add some spices, it's supposed to taste your white, good quality meat, but enhance or lift up those juices from the meat as well.
Yeah. Do you know why traditionally in, for instance, in the Caribbean, in the cooking, why spices were particularly used? What I know it came followed the spice routes, but
yeah,
was that part of it?
Yeah. There are a few stories. I mean, definitely the spice routes. So coming through Southeast Asia through traders going to African continent. I mean, there's almost no conversation about spices in the Caribbean and Southeast Asia and Africa without mentioning, you know, enslaved people. So they were trading spices and food between the colonies. You know, molasses and rum was coming back to North America and Europe while spices were being taken from various parts of the country, from Southeast Asia. But I also think that as African people inherently from a warm tropical place, it's just what we did. And I think as we also moved across to not our homes, but this new place, New America, you wanted to bring that memory with you. Right? Gonna mm-hmm. bring that profile with you. Mm-hmm. So some things were fine in the environment in the Caribbean because of the tropics. Some weren't found. And so later on, people are adopting and just finding what they have and then using what they can. So pimento, for example, is the essence of jerk. And it's distinctly a Jamaican innovative resistance way of cooking. And the pimento leaves, pimento seeds, was what was used to preserve meat at the time during a time of war. So I think it's memory. I think it's what was in their environment. And I think it's also just the tropics and what was available.
Yeah, that's really, I was reading recently something that it shouldn't have amazed me, but it did, that many of the things that we see both in the Caribbean and well, anywhere where slavery was from Africa, that we see that people actually brought seeds.
Yeah.
Things like okra, things that were not indigenous to where it was. They wanted that. They brought some of the seeds for the spices that they liked. Mm-hmm. So here are these people, you know, they're in slavery, and yet they're still bringing, you know, kind of in a way smuggling along with them a part of who they were. And it was a food culture that they were smuggling.
Yeah,
which is just amazing correct. To me. You know, I mean, that would be the last thing I think of, but you're right. Where is home? And so they wanted to recreate that feeling.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you know the writer, Michael Twitty. He writes a lot about food in the South. And one of the things that blew my mind is when he says that African-American food is only food that's called soul food. And the soul isn't even an actual place, right? It's not the physical realm. Your food is so important to who you are. You've named it after intangible, your soul. And that like stopped me in my tracks and go, you're right. It came with you. It's part of who you are. So soul food for me feels and sounds like resistance, innovation, adaptation, resilience. So you're right. Home is a place you've been, a place you long for, and your food can remind you of that.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, we, like we all do, we don't always get the best cut of meat. We don't always get, you know, the very freshest of vegetable, sometimes mm-hmm. really in the season or early, and spices become essential to, you know, enhancing, like you said, enhancing that and making that. And that makes sense for people that were in slavery as well. They generally were given the cast-offs, not the best of anything. Right. Yeah. And so it makes a whole lot of sense that you would enhance it. Right. But you'd also enhance it with a little bit of home. And I just, it's really, really, really amazing. I think the stories that come out of that. Do you have any really, you know, you have conversations with everybody. Do you have any conversations that you are kind of notable that you'd like to tell us about one of them?
About people? Food in general?
Yeah.
let me see. I mean, I talk about food all day, every day with people.
I know.
And I think one of the people or conversations that come to mind that's very different from my own culture, my own existence, and the essence of American food, right, is a woman who runs a program called Awafi Kitchen. And Awafi is really Jewish Islamic food. So Iraqi heritage, Jewish religion. And so they talk a lot, and I worked with us at Food and Folklore on a dinner series that was really to highlight that in the 70s, you know, Iraqis came here to the US and brought with their food. But while they're brown people of Arab descent, their religion is Jewish. And so that makes for an interesting food story of kosher food with Islamic, with kosher food with Arabic traditions. And so that was really, really, I think, something I haven't had experience with. I can't go to a restaurant and have, you know, Iraqi Jewish food. Mm-hmm. And so meeting Awafi Kitchen, Annabelle, I was just so impressed that they were taking their dad's home country that they haven't been to personally and making a story of that and sharing that with their peers here in the US, both first and second generation, also bicultural Iraqi Jewish folks through Awafi Kitchen.
Wow. And so in these conversations, you discover these things that you would never have known. I mean, it's not just about the food, but about the person.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of time we talk to humans, and if the Northeast, I love Boston, but I think in the Northeast, this is my experience, go by, oh, where have you gone to school? Who do you know? Where do you work? And that's great. I feel that's superficial, but almost every conversation about a person's home life gets to food, and you have a chance to see them at their core. Most times the eyes close, there's a smile, there's a memory.
Yeah.
And we almost become more human talking about our experiences through food than we would if I asked you, oh, Mark, where do you work, right? So that's why I tend to sit with my food people. There are lots of really honest conversations that could happen when you're honest in a person's home base.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, some of my work in the neighborhoods that I work with often centers around bringing people together from the neighborhood around a meal. It's probably the best way to get a conversation. And I know churches have figured that out as well as others, that if you have a meal, you can get a more rigorous kind of turnout as well as more conversation.
Yeah.
And I think you're right on, spot on with that, that idea of having food at the center of a way of starting a conversation, because who doesn't have that artistic feeling, right? It's who doesn't eat? You may not see a painting, you know, or that kind of have that experience, but who doesn't eat? And so who doesn't have that to talk about?
Yeah. Yeah. And so part of my work, I feel like my life work through Food and Folklore and this new project I'm working on called Dutch Pot is to really bring together culinary creatives. So those folks who are not necessarily a restaurant chef, right? And right. I respect and love and admire very many restaurant chefs. That's one way of bringing food to this world. But I think there are folks who are in this in-between space. They're not just a home cook. They're not quite a chef, but they're in between. They're storytellers. They're weavers of culture. They trade in intangibles, stories and styling and catering, and really they're about the audience or the folks they're serving. And they're serving not just a plate of food, they're serving themselves and their story and their communities on a plate. So that's where I like to sit, to reimagine a world where there are more diverse offerings. Restaurant fine dining, love it, right? Casual home cook, love it. But in between that, there are folks who are really cultural health practitioners who really want to trade in food stories in a more intangible way.
Yeah, you know, so I think there's food is so interesting. It's created a couple of phenomena I know that you know about. One is podcasts. There's so many food podcasts.
There are.
And there the are. Other one is there's so many cooking shows. And they aren't really about learning to cook. They're about the experience. I think of, you know, we always watch the Great British Baking Show because it's just really amazing, the challenges they have. But there's other ones. And it's just pervaded us because it is something, I think you're right, anyone can grab a hold of.
Even kids, I mean, it spreads the gamut from children to adults. Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah, please.
I'm not a super fan of cooking shows. I watch them. The ones I like are the ones that tell stories like Taste of Nation with Padma. I like the ones that go into neighborhoods. I love the ones that go into a restaurant and understand why that, for an example, that immigrant from a particular country started selling a particular meal to feed their community and they grew. So I love the stories of resilience and not so much just recipes, because I think you can follow along, and not to disrespect anyone who loves a cooking show, but I love the nuanced cooking shows. That's more about the story behind the food on a plate.
I really agree with you. I get really tired of the ones like Chopped and some of those. And again, but because it doesn't really help me to get it. But I love why I mentioned the Great British Baking Show. A lot of the people that were there that did well has spun off shows that are exactly what you're talking about, right? And I love those. You know, like Nadia. She Nadia cooks. So Nadia's got
her own thing.
And it's much more about culture. It's much more about, and I've started going back, and I don't know if you've watched any of these, but even Anthony Bourdain, some of the early ones, he was just, I mean, he was that, what you just said, right? It was much more about being there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he did consume some things that had me like, okay, that's not for me yet.
Yeah, but I know.
Again, I remember one episode he was in, I think Alaska, amongst Eskimos, like ice fishing. And I just had never thought about the Eskimo food experience during cold times. But he opened my mind to a different reality that wasn't my own.
He did. And I think what you're talking about too, opening our minds to different realities in terms of, okay, so where did that, you know, fermented milk come from?
Well,
you know, it came from a reason it was warm, hot.
Preservation.
Yeah. But then it became something culinary later. And it's, again, that taste of home. You know, what's home to you? How do you keep that with you? And I even think back to, you know, the nostalgic idea of the, you know, settlers moving west with the chuck wagon, or, you know, the cowboys or whatever. But they always had their little spice kit, you know. Yeah. That chef who had to feed cowboys or whatever, they had to take their spice kit. And I'm sure every one of those wagons that was moving west in the United States had spices with them. And so I think when people, we are migratory, all of us. Mm-hmm. And when we migrate, I think we take with us what's important, and food and spice is really important.
Yeah. And if you think about also to add to that, you're right, moving east to west, but also the great migration of folks moving from the south post Jim Crow up to places like Detroit and elsewhere. When you think about soul food or southern food, it came up from the south of America. I was in Louisiana a few years ago, and again, I was just in awe of the Dookie Chases and the folks who have been holding down the both Creole and Cajun food, right? Mm. In American South for many years, and where that came from, you know, the French Creole tradition of Creole food out of, you know, Haiti through Louisiana, and then the Cajun experience, which was completely different. But again, those two sit together in Louisiana to make New Orleans like that food mecca of the South.
Wow. I'm talking with Tamika Francis about her passion for global food traditions and spices and cooking. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Tamika Francis. And Tamika, You know, it makes me think about and reminds me of we're going on these little journeys, and it's, we get to go and we get to see what somebody else might call home in that part. But there's also, I know with you, two sides, which there are with many of us. And that's why I do this show. There's an art side and a science side. And so as a health practitioner, you've got steeped well in the science part. And then as a culinary professional, you've got it in the other. Why is it so important to have those together?
Yeah, great question. I am definitely a dichotomy. I have two things going on. So my formal training is in geography and conservation. So I came into this realm through the physical world. So I mean, you know, counting trees, rivers, science major, a geography major. And through that, I came into environmental health initially. So as I moved to Boston, the urban area, it was about the food and ecosystem. I ran for a while a tiny nonprofit that did farm-based education for urban kids.
Oh, wow.
So taking Boston Public Schools students in Somerville and Cambridge out to farms and mostly Metro West and the Cape as well, in Massachusetts, to understand the ecosystem, to understand food, to understand where their food came from. Also to understand the social justice ideas behind food, who grows your food, why does it cost, how much it does. And so I came into food through environmental health, and I recognized I found my place in public health working on food systems. So for the last few years, I've been a volunteer and board member with the Urban Farming Institute, again, because where your food comes from, growing your food in an urban environment, is so essential to the quality of your food, right? It's more nutrient dense. So as a culinary artist, yes, I love to see amazing spreads of meal and communal dining, but it's important that we also understand the health of our soil. We understand why farming in the commercial way is not exactly the best thing for our climate or for our world. And thinking about ways of like permaculture, you know, small scale urban farms, we may not be able to feed the entire world that way, but at least respecting that soil and soil science is important to the quality of the food that we eat. So I'm in both places as a culinary artist, but I do think because of my experience with geography and conservation, I also know the land and the people are important to the food we eat.
So you're speaking my language. I use the arts as a way to help people engage with something that's more difficult in science. That's what you're doing, right? You're using food, right?
Exactly.
To get us to the real essential science of soil health, you know, environmental health, just even carbon footprint and moving something. Right. Being in season, right? And that, I think that's something that we've lost too. We used to only have things in season. I mean, I've told my grandchildren, you know, particularly my seven-year-old, that not for me, but for my parents' generation and beyond that, it used to be a real treat to have fruit in your stocking and some nuts. And they thought, well, why would that be so special? Because it wasn't available. It
wasn't available, right.
Except that, you know, it was out of season. And so it was like really special.
Yeah.
And so you're right. I mean, we didn't have asparagus when it wasn't asparagus season. Now we do. We can get it from anywhere, but at a cost.
Yeah. And globalization is great. It allows for the trading of lots of supplies through all the countries very quickly. You know, cargo ships are going in and out of different docks. But at the same time, I think being mindful that every time we consume a thing that's not from our own environment, there's a cost to getting that to us, right? So I think, and I'm not a preacher, okay, you should stop doing anything, but be conscious, be cognizant, be aware that for you to have the strawberry outside of the summer strawberry season, there is a labor behind that. There is a land that was killed behind that. And the cost also is an implication of what it took to get a strawberry to us here in the US in December versus say at its peak in June. So I like to have those conversations as well. I like to bring who grows our food. You know, migrant laborers. I had an uncle who was a farm worker in Canada very many years ago as a kid. I didn't get what he did until years later. But the migration of folks to grow our food in the US and Canada is also important, why we can have such amazing abundance of food on our plates almost every single day. So being respectful of that as well.
Yeah. You know, you said something earlier that I wanted to go back to a little bit that ties into all this. And you used a phrase called weavers of culture.
Yeah.
And I love that because that's art and science and it's history and all those things, but can you expand a little bit more on what you mean by weavers of a culture?
For me, I'm bicultural, right? I've lived in the US for very many years now. My son is American born. I am Jamaican. I've lived in other Caribbean islands. So I think his experience and the experience I think of many folk, maybe your grandchildren, will not be a single culture. I think as we have conflict in this world, a way to get at our shared humanity is through exchanging of stories, yeah, conversations, ways of living, different thoughts. And so I think some of the folks I am lucky enough to work with who are culinary creatives, they are that. They're weavers of culture. They're sharing their experience with me through food. I share mine. And that exchange is so rich. The dialogue is so rich. It allows us to be more human together. So, and I'm not trying to get world peace through food, but I think we can achieve world peace through food. And the weavers culture are folks who both preserve. So you're holding on to the way your mother or your aunt or someone taught you, but because you're millennial or newer or American born, you may have a different perspective on that same recipe. And so the weaving of culture is blending those two things to then share a new thing, which I call hyphenated food, right? So yeah. if you're American Indian or this, whatever, what you share or what you share up is a hyphenated version of who you are. It blends both your family's history, but also your current lived experience and our current reality.
So why I love this word weavers in this context with culture is that I know a fair amount about weaving. And
you do.
One of the things that's interesting is that in weaving, you'll have a warp and you'll have, one that'll go across. And so you have these two things. And what's interesting is it makes a new cloth. However, it's never lost the threads of the original, right? And so when I take that as a metaphor for what you just said, you aren't essentially losing your culture, but you are putting it together to make a new beauty. And it's not, but you haven't lost it.
Right.
Because it's still in there. I mean, I could pull those threads apart in something, mm-hmm, and find the individual cultures, yeah, but at the same time. So it's a wonderful
metaphor. I'll go further with your metaphor, because then on its own, those threads are weaker. Together, it's stronger, it becomes cloth.
Correct.
Right?
That's just great.
So I've never liked the melting pot metaphor, because I feel like you lose. I think we can coexist together. When I add mine, you add yours. And that makes for either an amazing meal or amazing community or neighborhood and eventually a country. So I'm going to go further with your weaving analogy.
Yeah, as I think about it, I'm going to use that more often to think about when we have conversations. Our purpose for having them is to weave together. And a melting pot is a bad idea anyway, from the terms of a science, because melting pot means that it goes to chaos and you can't re-separate it. In other words, if I meld us together, there are no separate entities. It's now a completely new thing.
Yeah.
Whereas weaving, the separate entities still have soul, still exist,
but they're
together and they, yeah, make a strong weave, but I can also take them apart. As we know, if we get a hole in the sweater or something,
mend it.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. I think that idea of your weavers of culture, and that brings me to one other thing you said earlier. And I really want to know, what is Dutch pot?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for asking. So, as the world is evolving, we're into lots of virtual first experiences. Food and Folklore, my initial startup, was really about global food community, that question about what does home taste like for you. And through that experience, I have met amazing culinary talents across the country in general. And so I've been trying to figure out a way of both building an online community, but also systems on how we manage our businesses. So restaurants have amazing back of house HR, payroll, everything they need to do as a culinary creative. And this is my side hustle, as they call it. And I have a full-time job. I've been trying to figure out systems to run my business more efficiently. And so the Dutch Pot is a food tech startup that I'm a part of. And it's really an online community for culinary creatives to connect, to manage their projects collaboratively, to share resources, to have conversations. So it's definitely in the beta version right now. It's dutchpot.app. And we are building this online community of folks who will have conversation, exchange resources, and then also manage their clients through that portal.
Why Dutch? Why the word Dutch Pot? Where does that come from?
I'm funny you asked. So again, if I could go back to college, I'd be a cultural anthropologist, right? So the Dutch pot or the Dutch oven is one of those workhorse of the kitchen. Yeah. You can braise, stew, fry, roast. It's for stovetop. It's for oven use. I grew up with a Jamaican Dutch pot and they have different shapes and types. And for me, it was that the quintessential pan that every household had, right? It could be a Le Creuset. It could be a fancy French inspired Dutch pot or Dutch oven, but it could also be a poor like pot that every culture has one. That was my first like inspiration. But I later on learned that Paul Revere was the one who added the three legs to the Dutch oven in Massachusetts. So it's like a nod to my former home and my new home. And every culture has a Dutch oven, a Dutch pot. It's symbolic of that workhorse. It's also the pan you put everything in and something really good comes out of it. So I named the company Dutch Pot based on that.
I think that's brilliant. And I think that you've captured the essence there again of something that really cuts across. You know, yes, there's the high-end French kinds of pots.
Exactly.
They're really made to use on a more culinary kind of cooking surface than the other. But what you're talking about in a Dutch pot that most cultures had could have gone on a fire. It could have, you know, it was meant like we were a campfire. We could put it, you know, I always take a cast iron. I take a cast iron Dutch, would be a Dutch pot.
Yeah.
Right. And you can put it right in the coals. You can put coals on top of it. You can bake bread in it. You can do all these amazing creations.
So what, there is a Jamaican saying for what you just described, you'd bake what's called a pudding. So pudding was like like cassava or yuca or anything with sugar and coconut and milk. And the idea of the Dutch pot was hella top, hella bottom, hallelujah in the middle. And the idea is that there is heat on top, there is heat on the bottom, but that sweetness in the middle when it's done is like hallelujah, right? Or heaven for you. So that sits with me because Christmas time in particular, the holiday season is when you have that really nice like potato pudding. And so the Dutch pot for me is hell on top, hell on bottom, but that sweetness in the middle is what we deliver with our work at Culinary Creative.
Wow. What, yeah. I know this is going to be a little hard question, but what's your favorite thing to make in a Dutch pot, just off the top of your head quickly? I know there's
many. Curry, easy, curry.
So describe it for me.
Yeah, I love to do, I have a royal blue Dutch pot, right? It's one of those flatter ones or round belly, flat bottom. And I like to saute, I initially put my fat in, my oils with some garlic and saute that. I usually use a blend of like pre-made curry. So the curry usually has turmeric. It has some ginger, some allspice or pimento. It has some dose of ginger and clove. And then I'm blooming that in the fat with the garlic. And then I usually have either chicken or some kind of protein that's been chopped up and seasoned. And that goes in sizzling hot. I get a really nice sear on that. And so I'm going to have it sear for probably 3 to 5 minutes or so to get a nice little crust in. I flip those over and I saute that for a bit. I'm going to add onions and then that goes for a little bit. And then that simmers probably 10 to 15 minutes. I like to use dark meat chicken so it's more forgiving. And then I could add potatoes or carrots or bell peppers. And then the last bit is some coconut milk. So coconut milk for me with the curry kind of balances out that spicy flavor, right? The coconut milk goes in. I like to use either fresh thyme or cilantro. I cover that down. It goes for another 3 to 5 minutes. And that's served with either rice or yuca or some kind of grain or provision of some sort. It's one of my favorite meals to have.
You know, as you're doing it, and I'm sure our listeners are thinking the same thing, I could actually smell You said, you know, what was happening. And then you said, add the onions. And all of a sudden I could smell and I could imagine the steam coming off that, you know, as they go in. And oh my gosh, it's such a sensory experience to have you describe that.
Thank you. And the Dutch oven cast iron holds heat so well.
Oh, I know.
It holds, oh yeah, it's not forgiving. It holds heat very well. Yeah. So it's good for stewing, for braising. So definitely any kind of curry. It could be a vegetable curry as well. But I like to do a good, nice curry with lots of sauce in that Dutch oven.
It's really funny. I got started cooking in cast iron, not with the high end, but you know, my mom used to cook in a cast iron pan.
Yeah.
And it had gotten so well seasoned, but she didn't use it when the modern stuff came on, you know, with Teflon and nonstick and all that. She quit. So, so we got it, and there was this. It was so amazing because it was so well seasoned that my eggs didn't stick. Nothing was sticking to it, and they always stick to the nonstick. You know, you know what I mean?
Right.
Nonstick never really works, and it doesn't work for very long. And there's some other problems with it sometimes.
There are,
It starts to peel and some other. So, and it's not thick. It doesn't hold heat in the same way. It's amazing. So I've gotten down to where I almost can only do fish that way now.
In the Dutch,
you know, Seared both sides, stick it in the oven for about, you know, 12 to 14 minutes afterwards to finish it out.
The skin's beautiful.
Oh my gosh, it smells so good. But it doesn't stick. You know, it's just... when you get a seasoned pan,
it's foolproof.
It is. And
it's almost foolproof.
I encourage all people to get, you know, get themselves a cast iron pan or a Dutch oven and start cooking in it and see, follow through with seasoning it the right way.
Yes, caring for it.
Right. You will end up with this incredibly versatile thing that you will wonder, why do I ever use anything else?
But isn't this interesting, Mark? So Mark with family from West Virginia and live in, you know, Indianapolis, Tamika from Boston with family in Jamaica. We have a similar kitchen store with that Dutch oven, right?
Yeah.
Like to the naked eye, we have nothing in common. But then we go deeper in our stories and the way we cook in our Dutch oven is already one major connection between us.
Yeah. And I always was amazed, my grandmother and grandfather both you know, they helped serve other people during the Depression when they were poor, because he knew how to butcher and he would go do that for people. And then she worked for the West Virginia state government on canning and preserving, so people they had lost that art and helping do that. But what amazed me was when we were talking about a Dutch pot, it makes sense how she could extend a meal. So people would come visit unannounced. You know, that's how they were. And there'd be more, oh, come have dinner. There'd be more for dinner. All of a sudden, whatever we had got bigger. And she didn't have more chicken necessarily or more meat, but she could extend it in that pot with other vegetables, other, you know, sauce. And it's like there was never a lack of enough.
Right.
And that kind of cooking is what you're talking about. And that's what I learned, that there was always something more I could add. Mm-hmm.
And to go back to the environmental piece as well, back then animal protein. So I'm not vegan or vegetarian. I definitely am a meat eater, but we knew then that animal protein was really like a seasoning, right? It wasn't consumed as much. It was a flavor for your dishes. And I mean, a quick plug, but I'm doing a class with Curious Spices on this dish called a pilau. It's a one pot rice based dish with some meat. And speaking of foods from the African diaspora, or, you know, formerly enslaved people, but we wouldn't have a whole chicken per se for the most part. So small cuts of animal protein became the seasoning for a large one pot dish of either a stew or a rice. And so if you find, you know, the paella, pilau, there are very many dishes that are one pot with some bits of meat versus, say, the meat is a central force.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think what's interesting about that, it came out of a practical reason, but it ends up being, for me, I taste the meat more because it's special when I come across that little piece, you know, rather than a big hunk of meat in something, you know, it's like these little tasty morsels that just come.
That's a good perspective. You're right. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a treat.
Just a reminder that Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore really the intersections between art and science. We encourage you at home, the listener, to explore with your family and friends any of the ideas that we've been talking about on today's show, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation about eating and food and culture with Tamika Francis. Tamika, I know that your work has taken you to something I find to be really, really important. It's with children. And how are you involved with what you do with children?
Yeah, so children, the youth, the next generation, I think through or mentorship or influence in their life through either classes or conversations can really influence both how they choose their food, how they interact with other folks who are different from them. And so I've been doing for the last few years cooking classes across various nonprofits in Boston, the most recent one being Elevate Youth, which is an outdoor program in the Boston area that takes amazing youth from various Boston neighborhoods to the outdoors, to climb, to hike, to ski. We know how important outdoor recreation is for our growing minds. Again, geography major, so I'm a huge outdoors person. So their mission was really close to my heart. And we do a once monthly class called Eat. And what I love about the program is that they are procuring ingredients from the local Boston area, delivering to the homes of the youth, right? And then I am online for now offering a class based on the ingredients. And we've done, of course, seasonal cooking. So in the summertime, we're doing lots of berries. We're doing lots of salads. We just wrapped our holiday edition that looked into doing squash, the Three Sisters, and really going into Native American foodways and how the Three Sisters of corn and squash and beans were important to the ecology of the area. So we're using food both to offer a way for access around healthy eating, a skill, which is a hardcore skill to learn to chop and cut and stew and, you know, but also for them to understand seasonality, the outdoors, and how the intersection between the environment and their food is really so closely connected. So I absolutely enjoy the program. The team is amazing. It's one of the few programs I've worked with. There are a few others across Boston that I've done as well. I love absolutely doing it.
That just, you know, that idea of learning in general through food is so powerful. I think, you know, some of my work in museum work, a lot of the things that were more successful is when I would do an exhibit or a demonstration on cooking and food to get at the science. And
yes,
what they're doing, it's very scientific. And your mistakes, particularly, I think, in baking.
Baking
is pretty unforgiving of having the wrong amount of something. You know, you can get lumpy if you don't mix it right and all that. And
so over mixing.
Right. It gets across the idea of the chemistry that's happening there in a real way. And so then when they have chemistry later, it can make sense to them.
Yeah. And we go through life skills. So we talk about organizing. Oh, wow. So me's like preparing for, I have to say an organized chef is a good chef. So having them talk through prepping their ingredients. We talk through reading a recipe. So most recipes are organized in the order of use. So having them understand that breaking things down in order would help them break down a recipe easily. We talk about knife skills. So chopping, cutting, you know, safety. We explore different kinds of cooking methods. So we bake, we boil, we braise, and then the ingredients that are delivered to their homes usually are seasonal. We're talking about the importance of those ingredients and what they mean. Most of the families are cooking together, right? There's an adult in the space, whether a parent or not. And then we're encouraging them strongly to have that meal together in community at the end of the night. So it may be their only night that they're having a shared meal, but we really encourage them to cook the meal together, consume it together. And we have questions at the end. about what may have been their top learning. And it's always a delight to hear the stories. They're so honest. Oh, I didn't like this. Oh, I like this part. So youth are so honest, but I also can see their learning happening in real time.
Yeah, you can. And, you know, again, this is that time of year that when we do lots of traditions, and cooking is really a huge part of it.
Yeah.
But I think I would encourage anybody listening to do what you're talking about, Tamika, within their, whether it's their family or it's somebody next door that they invite over, to have those cooking traditions together where you make it together and then you consume it and have a conversation. And that if you are talking about bringing peace, that is one of the ways that we could do that, is by connecting through our food, not just preparing it for someone else, you know, not just having the mom or the dad prepare the food and then it's served, but having it communally prepared is a wonderful, wonderful way of engaging everybody.
And youth are leaving the home sometimes. They tend, I've read studies that say millennials, I'm a millennial, so I can blame my generation, are leaving the home not knowing how to pour cereal, right? Or not knowing how to prepare a meal. And I think it's an essential skill. I'm not advocating for everyone to become a home cook or a chef, but I do think it's a critical skill. If you think about saving money or learning science, there are just so many lessons to be learned from making food. I do think it would be a disservice not to get our youth involved in at least making a basic meal for themselves.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we still have a school system that separates those vocational skills of the culinary arts, woodworking, all that, for the kids that really can't go to college idea. And I was one of those kids that was identified that I'd never, by my high school, I would never go to college. You know, some adult thinks I won't go. And I went into those, and I have benefited my entire life from being in vocational work.
Yeah.
Because I then went to college afterwards and I had the other, they were so wrong. However, it isn't an either or. And we used to think it was important, right?
Yes.
So we had, it was still sexist, you know, when girls went to the one, but having everybody know how to sew on a button, everybody know how to put oil in a pan and how, what temperature to bring it up and when it's too hot and
you know,
which oils cook at what temperature. All those are really, really important life skills. And we all should be engaging in that. And so,
and I'm the opposite. I wanted to cook right after high school. I was sure I wanted to be a chef.
Yeah.
I did home economics and did cooking. I went to college and then I did culinary arts after college. When I hit my mid 30s, I realized there was this dream inside of me that I hadn't realized because I was smart, right? In quotation. So I went to college versus pursuing what I knew at 18 was what I wanted to do. But again, my school system, my own parents, love them dearly, but their own ideology of smart equals college. Again, the way the world is now, you can be both.
Yeah.
Be anything. And smart and vacation are not exclusive. You can be whatever you want to be.
No, and we really do need to encourage many, many more people to the jobs that are out there that are going unfilled are in the trades. And they're very difficult. I mean, when the plumber comes out to my house, it's amazing to me what they do, and you know, all the things they have to do with math and all the other applied skills. And so, you know, we'd be better at monitoring our food, right?
Right.
That somebody else is cooking for us in a restaurant, we'd be better able to judge it if we could do that. I don't know if you do this, but one of my fun things is to have something that I really liked in a restaurant and then see if I can figure out what was in it and then do it when I come home.
That's me.
Yeah, that's me. Was there cinnamon in that? I don't quite have it right. And then I'll go back and eat it again.
Yes.
And then try to refine it and go, what else is in there? Eventually, sometimes I'll ask, they won't always
tell
you, but I'll ask, will the chef tell me what's in this?
Yes.
And
my friends will see me eating and I'll close my eyes and I'll do a little thing with my tongue and go, oh, here she goes. Because I'm trying to like register that memory and go, cardamom.
Cardamom.
Usually that particular spice that's like subtle.
Yeah.
And you know it, but it's not upfront enough. So it takes you a while to like go back to find it. But yeah, I do the same thing at restaurants or whatever I eat. I usually sit there and try and figure it out. Or I'll ask the staff or whoever makes the food, like, what's this?
They're usually honored, by the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's one of the great things about cooking. Rarely is it a secret. Probably from some of the really top chefs that have to compete. Yeah. But beyond that, most people are really flattered and honored that you would like to do that.
They are. And if we ever have the honor of sharing a meal at a restaurant, you'll probably... I have ended up at the back of lots of restaurants, the back of house, because that's somehow the conversation goes in a direction. Either the chef is coming out and we chit chat, or I'm going back of house. I'm on this personal mission to go to, if not all, as many Black woman owned restaurants in America. We know this from data that woman owned chef restaurants are less than like 10%, probably really tiny. I'm probably getting that number wrong. So between the Nina Comptons, the Mashama Baileys, I've made it my personal mission to go to their restaurant because they're chef owners, right? And that's a tiny, tiny number. And I usually tell a really good story to get them to come front of house and say hello. So
how weird in, especially the United States, that most still of the cooking is done by women, but not professionally. I wanted to put it out there because it's true. It's really, to me, it's really bothersome. Because it's like so many of the things that where women are not valued for the skills and the talents that they have.
I'm impressed. And race, right? It's gender and race for most. Yeah,
absolutely.
Matriarchs, right? Whether it's the Mexican grandma, the Italian grandma, the matriarchs most times in a household are the ones passing down the oral tradition of a recipe to that son or to that daughter. But chances are the white male will become the celebrated chef. Can we still have that restaurant hierarchy system? And I already imagine a world where that's not the norm anymore, but there's space for lots of different kinds of people to be at the helm of different food businesses. That's my hope for the future.
Yeah, and that goes back to, it circles back into the idea of culture being a part of all of us and all of us sharing in that. And it's richer because all of us are there. And it does make me rethink, there is that, I mentioned that idea of food shows that are competitions and that, but they still tend to be sort of superstar dominated, particularly male dominated as well, and European descent dominated. And I think it's interesting that if we didn't do that, if we said that it was incredible enough that there were women of color who were slaves who were good enough and thought to be fantastic enough to cook for the whole family and the guests. And then somehow we marginalized that group. In other words, so it's really an interesting move for me to imagine there was somebody that really could handle that, could do all that, and was valued in that way. And then our culture doesn't value them when they're not a servant to us anymore.
So you are spot on. So Toni Tipton Martin, a personal hero of mine, she's the editor-in-chief at Cook's Country magazine. She writes a lot. She has a book called The Jemima Code that talks a lot about African-American, like centuries of African-American women in particular being at the forefront of food and in the homes of many. And so she does an amazing, amazing job of like documenting what that history is, what that story is. And again, we inherit restaurants that are predominantly white male centric. But I think there are some amazing folks like at the cusp right now who's changing that narrative, right? The Padmas, there's Kwame, there are a few like heroes, personal heroes of mine who are on the forefront of reimagining and creating a new world where we can all coexist and have lots of different stories told.
You know, this has been a really wonderful conversation. And when we talk, we could just keep talking. Tamika, I have Tamika Francis with me, and we've really been exploring health and food and culture and being a chef and just, I don't know. I get goosebumps when we think about it, and I have all these smells. Now I want to go cook. I hope that you at home do as well. Until we get together next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, and I'm reminding you, to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.